It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Congress is ready to move forward on a new economic stimulus package.
But don't expect them to call it that.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, February 15th.
Coming up, pointing fingers in Greece.
And why vacations are good for the economy.
Plus, the future leader of China continues his tour of the U.S.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Congressional negotiators have agreed to a deal that would extend the payroll tax cut through the end of the year. It would also extend unemployment benefits and maintain the pay of doctors who accept Medicare. All of that means more money will go into people's pockets, and perhaps they'll go out and spend it. You might call it economic stimulus, as Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports.
Here's what you need to know about the congressional deal.
It's a stimulus bill.
Tony Fratto is a managing director at Hamilton Place Strategies. He says that as the economy stays sluggish, we're in an era of seemingly endless government stimulus.
We're going to have additional stimulus to the end of 2012 at least, and the recession ended in the summer of 2009. That's a very, very long time.
But not all stimulus is created equal. Fratto thinks this one may be better than the huge stimulus bill passed in 2009, because today's spending avoids the red tape of the last bill. Stan Collender is a partner at Corvus Communications. He sees a major flaw in the agreement from Congress.
If you increase spending on one thing but cut spending on something else, then the net bottom line for the economy is the same. It's zero, and so you're not really stimulating very much.
But many experts agree it's at least worth a try. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
For more on this, let's bring in our regular Wednesday guest, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He joins me here in the studio. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Jeremy.
So is this stimulus?
Well, I guess it's a preservation of the status quo, and it would have probably been a negative had they not passed this. So it's not a bad thing, but I don't see it leading to any kind of sea change in the economy or the way people are spending money.
But it is more money into people's pockets, this payroll tax extension, which would mean, if it is stimulus or at least not non-stimulus, this is 4 years we've been trying to boost the economy with government spending. Is it working?
The most important thing for people to understand about what's happening and what's been happening is that this is a balance sheet recession. So you can give money to people, but you can't make them spend it, especially when they're in deleveraging mode. This is not something that wraps up in 2 or 3 years. It takes a very long time. There aren't a lot of examples of it, but no one should expect an extra $50 on someone's paycheck to lead to some kind of massive increase in spending.
Deleveraging mode, by the way, you mean people are trying to get out of debt.
People are bringing down the level of debt they have. They are building back up their savings, and spending is a tertiary priority.
All right, well, let's talk about debt in Europe. The European debt crisis, another big story today. The big meeting that was supposed to happen to decide if Greece was going to get more bailout money pushed back. Another missed deadline. How closely are you watching this?
Jeremy, I would really be scared if they actually made a meeting on time. I think the way to look at Europe is, obviously, the risks are very well known. If a major bank there blows up, it could be a big problem for banks around the world and maybe force businesses to rein in what their plans were. But barring that, nobody should look at this as it's something that can either be resolved or blow up in one day. I think this is just going to be a continual albatross around everyone's neck, but it seems to matter less and less as U.S. businesses pick themselves up off the pavement and start to do more. And in fact, we saw that this morning in the Empire Manufacturing Survey, which is 175 manufacturing companies from around New York State. And it's pretty significant because it's the third increase in a row, and it's a huge jump in February over January.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much as always, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure, Jeremy.
Oil prices hit a six-month high today. That's as tensions grow in the Middle East. We have reports this morning that an explosion hit an oil pipeline in Syria. Political tensions have also threatened the oil industry in Sudan, Yemen, and Iran. For more, we go to Mehdi Varzi. He's director of an energy consulting firm in London. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how significant is the news out of Syria today and this bump we're seeing in oil prices?
Well, I think the whole thing is that Syria is a very small oil producer. And the global market, the global oil market, in terms of what it has in terms of surplus production capacity, is very tight. In terms of any potential shortfall, there is not that much extra surplus capacity to bring onto the market. And that is what is, I believe, partly boosting oil prices. Any event elsewhere, whether it's in Syria, in Yemen, or in Nigeria, will tend to have an underpinning effect, as it were, behind oil prices.
Now, what other concerns are driving the market up today?
Well, the key concern, quite frankly, is it's a bigger thing altogether, which is the whole issue around the Persian Gulf and whether or not the Straits of Hormuz will be closed, what impact there will be on the market if Israel decides to launch a preemptive strike against Iran. These are much bigger factors than Syria or Yemen or Sudan or elsewhere.
Mr. Varzi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
European finance ministers, as we said with Josh Brown, were supposed to meet in Brussels today, but they decided to hold off. They wanted more assurances from Greek leaders that they'll make the spending cuts they've promised. The head of Greece's Conservative Party has just sent a letter promising that.
But the big question of the day, who's really to blame for the mess? Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Greek protesters seem to blame everyone but themselves for this crisis. Despina Katsoumba, a public sector worker, points the finger at the markets for speculating against Greek government bonds.
When did we decide that markets can rule the world? Do we vote for markets? We vote for governors and we're ruled by markets, by people that we don't even know, by people that earn from our disaster.
Others blame Greece's European partners, and especially Germany, for failing to bail out Greece as soon as the crisis erupted. Student Anna Maria Piscopani.
There was a very small problem at the beginning, but they did not do anything to prevent it, and some of them took advantage of it also.
But most Greeks now accept the cause of the crisis lies much closer to home. Here's Spiros Kapralos, a shipping company boss.
First, it's Greece's fault. I think that we created a monster in the public sector that is eating a lot of resources.
Greece has borrowed almost $500 billion to pay, among other things, inflated wages and for early retirement in the public sector, and to pay for high-profile public projects like the Olympics. Economists say this has driven Greece to the brink of bankruptcy. Stefanos Manos, a former finance minister, says Greek voters are to blame.
We voted for whoever spent the most, and we did not look where the money came from. The guys were borrowing money. They were borrowing and borrowing and spending it, and people who didn't look further were very happy.
Greece's European partners postponed today's meeting on the bailout, claiming that Greece has not yet shown that it's prepared to mend its ways. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
We're coming up on George Washington's birthday, which we observe, of course, as President's Day. That means a three-day weekend for many American workers, but not everyone will be kicking back. And that is a problem, says LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how do we stack up holiday and vacation-wise in this country?
Not so well, it turns out. If you look at other industrialized countries, for example, the European Union, Japan, Canada, Australia, they guarantee at a minimum 10 to 20 days of paid leave every year. In France, it's 30 days. In the United States, our guaranteed paid leave, zero.
Wow.
Zero. And then you look at vacation days. In the rest of the world, paid holidays, guaranteed, vary from 5 days to about 2 weeks. In the United States, zero.
But I've read, David, that some people don't even take the vacation days that they have. They get vacation time from their employer, but they don't even take it.
This is true. In fact, some surveys show that about half of all U.S. workers do not take all their allotted time off, which raises the real question, why is that? And I think the answer is going to be because there's a lot of pressure from our employers not to be out of sight for too long. And in fact, when you do take a vacation, you're expected to kind of still be reachable via your BlackBerry or your iPhone.
Well, so therefore, should you take vacation day? Should you take the vacation that you're given? Or should you worry that if you do, you're going to get fired or something?
Well, it's a two-lane street here. On the one hand, you're going to have a better quality of life if you take your vacation time, and you'll probably be a better person for it. On the other hand, your employer is probably going to look at you and think, God, that guy's a slacker.
Well, although some people would look at this and say, at least the U.S. economy, it's a hard-working economy. Yes, maybe we work ourselves too hard, but we're doing better right now than the economies of Europe, which do, as you say, have more vacation time.
Yeah, and you ask the World Economic Forum, and they say, look at the United States. They have the fourth most competitive economy in the world, except then you bring in Sweden, which guarantees 5 weeks off for its workers every year, and they have the second most competitive economy.
Time to move to Sweden. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. David, thanks a lot.
I need a vacation.
So do I. Adrian, do you need a vacation?
I do, and I don't get the holiday off, so no shopping by me.
Oh,
I know.
Sorry. Cisco, Adrian, has come out with its annual forecast for mobile devices and says that by the end of this year, there will be more mobile devices than people on Earth.
That's astounding.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, it says that by the end of 2016, in just a few years, while there will be 7.3 billion people on Earth, there will be 10 billion mobile devices on Earth. And I'm hoping that by then we will be able to come up with some different ringtones. Does anybody use that one anymore?
I think I actually heard it this week somewhere.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I just have my phone on vibrate at this point. I just find ringtones really awful. So hopefully we can just do away with them altogether by the time the mobile devices take over the planet.
The future leader of China starts his day in D.C. before heading to Iowa. Yesterday, Xi Jinping met with corporate leaders at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and Marketplace's Scott Tong tagged along.
Xi Jinping's meeting with CEOs from companies like Coke and Disney was scripted, as expected. Still, Vice President Joe Biden spoke fairly directly about the rules of the game, as in China playing fair in global markets.
We have work to do, especially on issues like discriminatory subsidies, protecting intellectual property and trade secrets.
For his part, Mr. Xi said the Chinese economy is pivoting from the world's factory to the world's shopping mall. And new consumers for American products is what the CEOs are after, says Yale economist Stephen Roach. He's former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia.
China's our third largest and most rapidly growing export market. Shame on us if we can't take advantage of the coming change in the Chinese economy.
And he says, shame on us could happen if simmering trade tensions bubble over into tariffs and trade war, leading Beijing to close off its markets. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So as we said, Vice President, soon to be President of China, is heading to Iowa today. It turns out, though, that this isn't Xi Jinping's first visit to the state.
In today's Midday Extra, we have Eleanor Dvorak with us, who hosted the leader back on his trip in 1985. Good morning, Eleanor.
Good morning.
So tell me, what was Mr. Xi like when he lived with you on the exchange program?
I saw him as a very focused, intelligent, mild-mannered guest, very busy, and my job was not only to provide him with a room, but hopefully some peace and quiet, some respite after some very busy days visiting with different people, learning about some of the Iowa farming techniques. The province that he came from had many pig farms, and we have them here, of course, in Iowa, and he did visit, I think it was Tom Hoop's farm, here in Muscatine, Iowa, to see some of the techniques. So I feel like we played a very small part, but nevertheless, he did stay at the house, and apparently between all of us, he felt very welcomed, and we're certainly glad that he did.
Were there any culture shock moments for you, things that you remember when he sort of noticed something very different about Iowa than where he was coming from and had a conversation with you about it?
Well, his English was limited and my Chinese was at zero. So we didn't really have a chance to have any lengthy kind of conversation. But I noticed he was very busy, always taking everything in. Who knows what I might have been trying to show him or direct him to. He was taking that in and everything else. Very focused and very smart man. He was taking it all in.
When you think back to the time he spent in your home, do you remember, did you eat any meals with him?
Just breakfast.
What'd you serve him?
Probably we did a lot of pointing, you know, coffee, tea. I have a feeling it probably was cornflakes, being that we do raise an awful lot of corn in Iowa. But they're light eaters, so it wouldn't have been, you know, too much. And, you know, when they're going about all day with their colleagues, they're always offered lunch and snacks and everything. So there was no need to have a tremendous breakfast. And it, 9 chances out of 10, it was light and it was probably cornflakes and tea.
Eleanor, tell me what you thought when you found out that he's in line to basically be the next leader of China.
Well, I think the very first phone call was from the policy advisor in Des Moines on October the 31st, and it crossed my mind, my goodness, this can't be a prank phone call, can it? I mean, really, think about it, you know. But anyhow, we didn't react to it. We needed to give it time to sink in. And then, you know, it was confirmed that he was coming and he will be the next president. And so things started to kick in. As far as making our visit up to Iowa. We certainly wanted to, but it was really difficult to leave, have an awful lot of animals back at in Florida.
And how does it make you feel to know that this man that you hosted so many years ago is about to be in charge in China?
I'm honored. I mean, beyond belief. My husband and I are honored beyond belief to think a man that busy would come back and make the time. And really, it's quite a bit of time, considering the flight and to get him into Muscatine. I'm so glad he doesn't have to deal with a big snowstorm. But it's such an honor. It's beyond belief that he would find the time to do that. So there isn't any distance that we wouldn't travel to try to return the honor.
Well, Eleanor, enjoy your time today, then.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We certainly will.
We've got a new top dog this morning. A Pekingese named Malachi won Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show.
But one of the usual pedigrees was missing, pedigree dog food. Westminster dropped the sponsor this year, saying pedigrees ads that promote shelter dogs turned off its audience.
Shelter dogs aren't broken. They've simply experienced more life. If they were human, we would call them wise.
And while pedigree may be out, it might not be the real loser. Sally Herships has more.
Purina must feel like it's in doggy heaven. Up to 5 million sets of eyeballs were expected to watch its ads at this year's Westminster Dog Show. Every pair represents a potential customer. And here is the message they're getting.
We know more about dogs than anybody else in the world. We judge dogs and take care of dogs, and we believe in this brand.
Ron Goodstein teaches marketing at Georgetown. He says pedigree has lost a major advertising opportunity, but Westminster's decision to dump its old sponsor may make it look snooty. Michelle Hollow is the author of the blog PetNewsAndViews.com.
That was the one thing about Westminster that a lot of us liked, that, okay, they are promoting purebreds. We understand that. It's a business. But they were doing something kind and talking about these shelter animals.
Now it's pet owners who are talking. Pedigree says since it was dropped by Westminster, the brand has received an outpouring of support on social media. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And Jeremy, one more bone for rescue dogs out there. Remember not that long ago when Chihuahuas were the latest celebrity fashion accessory?
How could I forget the great Paris Hilton with her Chihuahua?
Exactly. So it turns out the popularity of Chihuahuas has faded, as popularity so often does. And there's a glut of the little dogs here in California. MSNBC is reporting that California animal shelters are looking to send them out of state, looking for new Chihuahua homes away from the city, sending them to Seattle and Idaho and to New York City. Where
see,
I guess Chihuahuas are still okay.
Yeah, well, I can see a Chihuahua hanging around in New York City. It seems like a good place for them, small apartments and that sort of thing. But Idaho. That might be rough. I don't think they're really good out in the wild.
It'd be kind of funny. Little dog, big state.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.